Well, I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
Hi there.
And we have a delightful and very well-known in Fairfield guest with us today.
Indeed, indeed. And Jennifer Hawthorne. And we're just going to really, really enjoy this because she has some great things to tell us.
Jennifer Reed Hawthorne is co-author of the number one New York Times bestsellers Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul and Chicken Soup for the Mother's Soul. She's an inspirational writer, speaker, and educator. She has a passion for exploring consciousness and the development of human potential. And please help me welcome Jennifer Reed Hawthorne to Writer's Voices.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
Well, we are honored to have you. I've been, since we started the show a year ago, you've been on my list of people to have on the
show.
Thank
you.
But I wanted to wait until we were good enough for you.
Well, I've been listening to your show, and I've really been enjoying it. So thank you. Now I'm doubly honored.
We really have a wealth of literature in Fairfield, writers, publishers, editors, you know. Just amazing.
We really do.
Yeah.
I've been very fortunate to work with many of them,
mm-hmm.
too.
Yeah.
Now, how long have you been in Fairfield? I know you were gone for a while.
Not really.
Not really.
I had another place for a while up in Minneapolis, but I always kept my home here, and I've been here for 27 years now.
Wow.
Since 1980. Yeah, that's when I first moved to Fairfield. So.
Now, you were originally from Baton Rouge?
That's right, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I was born and raised there. And went to college there, graduated from LSU.
And then came to Fairfield not too long after that?
No, it was another 11 years or so. I graduated from college in 1969, and it was 1980 when I moved to Fairfield.
Wow.
So I had various jobs and things, including teaching TM in Florida and Baton Rouge in between those times.
Now, do you think of yourself as an Iowan at this point?
No, I've actually never, ever, ever been able to relate to being an Iowan. And every time I tell someone that I'm from Iowa, I think, I should be saying New York or California or something, because those areas seem to sort of match me a little bit better. But I must say that whenever I think about leaving here or moving away, and I have tried several times, I just really fall in love all over again with Fairfield, and there are so many things here that I cherish. I love the small town living and the ease of living here. And so mm-hmm. I don't know what's going to happen, but I've been here for a long time, and I don't see myself going anywhere anytime soon.
You certainly don't have a southern drawl.
Until I get around another southerner.
Oh, okay.
Until we start talking about Baton Rouge, and then you'll hear it start coming out.
Yeah, I understand.
Well, Jennifer, how did you become a writer? Let's start with the basics here.
Well, you know, I think it was really through the door of public speaking. I've been a speaker for a long time, and I would have to say that I started speaking at a very, very young age. I was about 7 years old when I used to gather up all the kids in my neighborhood and have them sit in rows on my driveway so
yeah,
that I could talk to them. And I always seemed to have something to say to them. And I think that it was really, it was as a speaker, after Marcy Shimoff, who was a former Fairfield resident that many of our listeners know and love, she and I had started a speaking business back in the early 90s, and it was because of Marcy's affiliation with Jack Canfield that we actually got involved in the Chicken Soup for the Soul books, and I started writing. I had had a number of writing jobs at that point, but never really saw myself as a writer, despite the fact that I was working as a technical writer and, you know, had jobs writing
and
procedures.
And you had a degree in journalism.
And I had a degree in journalism, that's right. But I never really saw myself as a writer, particularly not a writer of books. I just seemed to have a gift with words. I grew up in a family where my father was a master storyteller. He had beautiful, beautiful command of English. My mother, who's still living, is British. And so I grew up in a family that really, really loved language. And that really rubbed off on me a lot. And so I think that one of the things that I found myself doing very naturally, wherever I went, whatever kind of job I was doing, I would end up writing the manual. You know, if I was getting ready to take a new job, I would say, okay, well, I want to really take care of whoever comes after me. And I would sit down and I would write out the procedures, which, of course, was the beginning of a career of some years as a technical writer.
So you didn't set out to be a technical writer. It just sort of happened.
Just happened. That's right. And then I ended up teaching technical writing for many years in the corporate world and business writing for many years. And I think it wasn't because I was so skilled as a writer. It was just that I had a gift of taking a body of knowledge and simplifying it.
It's very important. Really, it is, because, you know, like if you get a manual for something that you have to put together and it's written poorly, you're lost.
It's really true. And so I think that even when I was 7 years old and, you know, talking to the children in my neighborhood, it was probably about something that everybody thought was somewhat complex. And I felt that I had, you know, I had a way to make it simple for
them. You had the answer.
And I really, really love doing that, even today with, you know, where my topic is more what I would really call the wisdom that I've accumulated in life through my life's experiences and my study. And I think that I really love being able to take the deepest, most spiritual principles that I understand, that I experience, that I find operating in my life, and put them into a format like Chicken Soup for the Soul to really bring them to mainstream America.
And one of the main ways that this format does that is through the use of stories.
That's right.
Which takes us back to your early childhood with your father.
Yes.
Because I remember you telling me this probably 20 years ago about your father, and even though we hadn't discussed it in all these years, I remembered you talking about your father and his Burr Rabbit stories.
That's right. In fact, he visited Fairfield in the early 90s and shared some of his stories in a public event over
Maybe
at the community center.
Maybe that's what I'm remembering. Yes.
Yes. My father wrote close to 500 original Brer Rabbit stories during his life.
Oh,
and in his young adulthood, he actually performed the stories as well, doing all of the voices of all the characters. He started doing that at the age of 9 on radio in Baton Rouge and did it through his entire life. He was very, very popular in Baton Rouge and all over the South, actually. And he, at one point, had a radio show on the Liberty Network, which consisted of several hundred radio stations around the country. And he would write and produce and perform a story a week for radio.
So you come by writing naturally.
Well, by storytelling, for sure, because that was our bedtime storytelling. And I remember my little sister, my next sister, and I shared a room, and we had twin beds. And our evening routine was that my father would come in, and he would sit on the floor between our beds, and he would tell us a story, and then we would beg him for another one and another one and another one. And sometimes he would say, okay, I'll tell you another one, but you know, you're going to have to help, because we were always begging him to make up new ones.
Mm.
So he would say, okay, you give me the storyline and let's see where it goes.
Oh.
So we would make up a topic and he would create a story, you know, right on the spot. He was incredible.
And then did he sometimes use those impromptu stories in his radio show later on? Did he write them down?
I'm sure that he did, but I'm also sure that he didn't worry about it, because his creativity was so strong that it was just something that he really could do very, very easily.
Now, I grew up knowing about, you know, hearing Burr Rabbit stories, knowing Burr Rabbit stories. I don't know where I heard them or how, but I thought they were old folk tales that have been around for a long time.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too.
Yes, well, they are. They were originally popularized in the late 19th century by Joel Chandler Harris, who was the person to really bring these characters from folklore into the public eye. The characters like Brer Rabbit and Brer Bear, and especially the character of Uncle Remus. That was Joel Chandler Harris's creation.
Okay.
So, but because they were from folklore, those characters, like anything from folklore, are not copyrightable. So, not even the publisher,
right,
you know, had a copyright on those. And so my father would take the characters that Joel Chandler Harris had talked about, and then he made up many characters himself. And at one point he had a puppet show on TV, and he actually made the puppets from paper mache. And, you know, he was really extraordinary. So that was sort of the colorful background of storytelling that I grew up with.
So you sounds like you came from a very creative background, and you had a lot of creative impulses. But then when you went to college, you decided to study journalism, which is perhaps on the less creative side in some people's minds, although there's a lot of creativity, of course, in journalism too. But what do you think drew you to that, to the more left-brain
side? I think
side?
I went into it by default. I think I was really struggling with what to major in college. And because my father had been a journalist and was a television journalist and a newsman, I think that was a tremendous influence on me even at that time. And so I majored in journalism, and I minored in speech and broadcasting. And
okay.
And that was really my great love always. I mean, even in high school, I took 4 years of speech as an elective. That's 8 semesters, count them, of speech as an elective. And anybody who ever hears that says, no, you've got to be kidding me, right?
It was
nobody
the same
does
class
that.
Every time?
No, it was a different class. It was the same speech teacher,
mm-hmm.
Who is one of, I would say, the 2 greatest mentors in my life, the other being Jack Canfield, the creator of the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. But he and Mrs. Marjorie Dyer, my high school speech teacher, are the 2 greatest mentors of my life.
Where I went to high school, they didn't have 8 different speech classes. There may have been 2
yeah.
semesters, and that was it. So you were very fortunate to be able to have that.
Yeah, it was really remarkable because, you know, we did everything from pantomiming to plays to writing speeches. We wrote lots and lots and lots of speeches, and that was always one of my favorite things to do. In fact, I entered my first speech contest when I was in the 8th grade.
Wow.
It was in 4-H. And I had just joined 4-H, which is something that a lot of people in Louisiana do, even though I was a city girl. And I heard about this speech contest, and they said all you have to do is write a 4-minute speech about the 4-H pledge. And I thought, wow, that sounds so easy. That sounds so fun. And I sat down, and I wrote this speech, and I learned it, and I got up and did it, and I won. And it was just as if I was born to do that kind of thing.
Well, obviously you were.
Thank you. And I haven't stopped talking since.
We're speaking today with Jennifer Reed Hawthorne, and we do want to mention her new book also, Chicken Soup for the Soul, Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live. And I should also mention that we're on Writer's Voices, in case you've just tuned in. So, Jennifer, you talked about how you got into technical writing, and then from technical writing, it sounds like you began to teach technical writing and business writing, which brought you back into speaking again, into public speaking. So it seems like both the writing and the speaking that you've sort of gone back and forth, and how do those two careers kind of feed one another?
Very beautifully, I must say, because when I have a chance to give a talk, it then gives me a chance to write about the material I've spoken about, and then sometimes I'll start from the writing side and end up giving a speech based on what I've written. So, for example, right now, the format of Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live excites me more than anything that I've ever done, because I feel as though it is just a perfect format for me to take so many of the principles that I've learned in life, that operate in my life, that allow me to love my life no matter what the circumstances are. So for me, the book is a platform for being able to talk to people about things that I care passionately about. But on the flip side of that, last Friday, for example, I was in Sarasota, Florida. I did three events there, one of which was that I spoke to 600 6th, 7th, and 8th grade students at the Pine View School for the Gifted, just outside of Sarasota. And my host, Dr. Ali Tahiri, is one of the featured contributors in my book, and I actually am going to share that story with you today. But Dr. Tahiri asked me if I would please write something up after the talk to send to the school newspaper. This is a school that is 100% gifted children. And he said, will you write something up for Pine Views, which is the name of the school publication, you know, sort of summarizing the main points so that it can be a follow-up and a reinforcement for the children. And I said, yes, that's a fantastic idea. So a couple of days ago, I sat down and I just went through and I wrote down the top 11 points that I felt that I had talked about in my short time with them. And that's the basis of an article. I mean, it is the article for the school newspaper, but mm-hmm. it's also something that I can use for other articles. And I'm a regular contributor, a regular columnist for Affluent Magazine and for Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise online transformational magazine and several others.
So you have to produce articles every month?
That's right.
More than one every month?
Usually what I do, because I'm a regular correspondent for Affluent Magazine, I let that get published first, mm-hmm. and then I share it with a couple of other websites, Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, and then also Jim Blassingame, who has a national radio show called The Small Business Advocate. He has a fantastic website to help small business owners, and I'm a regular guest on his radio show. And now on his website as well with articles that people can look up. So generally I write an article, publish it in Affluent, and then a month or so later I let these other online publications have the same article.
And I would assume that sometimes those articles become part of a book later? Or, you know, the topics that you cover in the articles can be used in
That hasn't right. happened. That hasn't happened yet. mostly, it's been the other way around for me. That the material, like right now, the life lessons for loving the way you live material is just such rich material for me to base articles on. That's really what I'm doing. I'm writing articles based on the book. That could change, but that's sort of the flow right now.
So you're out there.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And really enjoying it, I must say. Nothing is a pressure. I've really learned so much from my own writing, interestingly enough. I've really, really taken to heart so much of what I've learned from the people that I have interviewed over the years and whose stories I've written. And I really am trying to practice many of these things, and it's making a difference. So I don't work under deadlines much anymore. I do things from just the place of pure enjoyment. And then I start well enough in advance so that I'm not pressured down to the last minute.
How fortunate you are to be able to do that, because, you know, so many people spend their life doing something that they have no passion for.
Mm. Yeah, it's very true.
Yeah. To really feel sorry for those people.
Now, I'm wondering, Jennifer, did you like set out to do to do these things that you've done? Did you have specific goals, or was it a more organic process?
I love that question. And the reason I'm laughing is that I think it's the fourth lesson in this book that is let go of goals. I have worked a lot during my life with goal setting, and I really believed at one time that you could make anything happen if you just put enough attention on it and went over your goals enough and visualized enough. That's a very, very popular idea in the self-help world right now.
Right now, yes.
I actually don't agree with it very much at all.
And I agree with you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I agree with you as well.
And the reason is my own experience. Because
exactly.
What I have experienced in life is that no matter how much attention I put on certain goals, they've never come to pass. And some of the greatest things that have happened to me in terms of accomplishments or in terms of success or even in terms of my own deep understanding and wisdom are things that I never even thought to put on a list of goals. And so I really, really love Stephen Shapiro. He's been a tremendous influence in my life. He wrote a book about letting go, about goal-free living.
I saw that in your book, and it made me want to go read.
It's a terrific book.
I've been saying this a long time to friends, and I think I feel like I'm kind of fighting an upstream battle, because especially around here, the whole idea of goal setting and visualizing and
is that what
so prominent.
The secret is all about?
Yeah. Definitely.
Is, yes. Yeah. And it's such a prominent idea. But what I always like to say is for me, success came from doing my best at whatever showed up that day.
Beautiful. I love that. I love that. And also, I'll just mention that in February, I had the great blessing of going to India and spending a couple of weeks with the great Advaita master, Ramesh Balsekar. And one of the things I came home with and started my book with, which was a 10-week process, completely different from any book I've ever written. And this is my seventh book. What I really came away with was an understanding that all of us have a particular destiny. And I asked Ramesh very specifically about this thing of intention, and I told him it was very, very big right now in the West, this idea that we could set an intention, and if we did it well enough or perfectly enough or spent enough time with it, that it would come to pass. And I asked him to comment on that. And he just answered it so exquisitely for me. He said, if it is a person's destiny for that particular intention to come to pass, nothing that person could do could stop that thing from coming to pass. And if they happen to have an intention in that direction along the way, it's that the intention was a mechanism through which that happened.
Oh. Yeah.
And I think, I mean, it just resonates so deeply with me. It just resonates so deeply with me. And I think we get mixed up because we think, oh, I had this desire and it came
to
pass. It got fulfilled, and it got fulfilled because I had the desire. No, probably you had the desire because it was in your destiny to have that particular thing happen to you. Mm. That's why the impulse arose in the first place. Because certainly impulses and desires give us a direction.
Right.
They give us a focus
to help
our
you
attention.
To help you accept that whatever it was, the impulse came to help you accept the destiny, perhaps.
Possibly so, and possibly to act on it, because we are human beings and we do act in the world. We don't just, you know, lie in bed all day. And even with the understanding that I am not the doer, action is still happening through me. So in other words, for a book like Life Lessons to happen, I had to actually sit at my computer. I had to
do a lot of thinking,
a lot of interviewing. There had to be a really nice flow of creativity, you know, for this book to come through me.
Right.
But I think that the greatest blessing of this book was the process, which was that I really experienced for the first time two very interesting, almost paradoxical things. One, that for the first time in my life, I was really a writer. And two, that I was not doing the writing. And that the more I just woke up every morning and thought, wow, I wonder what's going to happen today. I wonder what's going to come through me today. The greater the creativity seemed to flow and to be accessible to me. It was a remarkable experience for me.
Well, Jennifer, tell us what you mean by this book being the first time that you felt that you were a writer.
Well, I think that for the first four books I did, they were all Chicken Soup for the Soul books. And as anybody knows who's ever read a Chicken Soup for the Soul book or even looked at one, the Chicken Soup for the Soul books, prior to the Life Lessons line that they came out with a couple of years ago, they're all collections of stories. Most of the books have 101 stories to open the heart and rekindle the spirit of a particular group of people. So my first book, of course, was Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul, as you mentioned, and that was stories to really, really touch the hearts of women very, very deeply. It's a very different process to be managing text, which is really what we were doing. Mm. We've always been called co-authors, mostly because most of us have had stories included in the collection. So we were published in that way. But more than co-authors, we were really editors of those books and doing, mm-hmm. most of the Chicken Soup books are managed texts. And so we had the task of reading, gathering, looking for, combing, you know, any source that we could possibly find for what ultimately became thousands of stories to be able to come up with 100 really great, powerful, moving stories for Chicken Soup for the Soul book. So there was very little original writing. The skill came more in the recognition of what was a very powerful story that right. could really have the potential to transform a reader's life or give that person inspiration. And then also in the organization of the material into beautiful, coherent chapters and in an order that made sense. I mean, that was a tremendous job and one that I thoroughly enjoyed. But it wasn't until my sixth book, The Soul of Success, and then Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live, that I actually did my own original writing as introductions to stories and then called upon stories to illustrate in a very deep and powerful or moving way what the life lesson was. And then to tell you the truth, in these last two books, I actually, although the stories are written in first person, I wrote most of the stories because most of the people I interviewed were not writers.
Okay.
And so they would
tell
me their story and right. or they would send me a rough draft and mm-hmm. usually I would just you know, edit it dramatically.
Now in the earlier Chicken Soup books, were you doing a lot of deep editing or revision of people's stories as well?
Oh, very much so. Right. Very much so. We had thousands of stories submitted to us. You know, when the Chicken Soup for the Soul books became so popular in the mid-90s, there started to be at the end of every book an invitation for people to contribute their stories. And so, you know, millions of people wanting to be published authors and writers, you know, would send their stories in. And of mm-hmm. course, today the process has become so refined and is so sophisticated that if you want to submit a story for Chicken Soup for the Soul, you go to the Chicken Soup for the Soul website and you find the place where you can submit your story and what the guidelines are. And here's a list of all the books that are going to be published, you know, in the future. So here are your topics. And it's, you know, it's a very refined process. Marcy and I didn't have anything like that when we did our first four books.
I bet. Well, how did you get involved with the Chicken Soup for the Soul series?
It was actually through Marcy Shymoff, who was my business partner at the time. We had started a speaking business together. We were both trainers in the corporate world. We were both teaching business writing to corporations like AT&T. And Marcy had studied self-esteem with Jack Canfield, who was the originator of the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. And in the very early days of our speaking business, we went to Jack and asked his permission to start using stories from the early Chicken Soup for the Soul books and to also do a keynote address, offer as one of our seminars and one of our keynote addresses, a talk using the name Chicken Soup for the Soul. And we started doing that with his permission. And very early on, we realized that men and women often responded very differently to certain stories. Mm. And that's what made us realize that it would really be great to have a Chicken Soup for the Soul book just for women. And so we approached Jack with a proposal. And to make a long story short, he said yes. And that was the opening of a very, very beautiful door for us.
Now, do you feel that this whole series, you know, all these different niche books would have happened if you hadn't come forth with this proposal? Or did you and Marcy start it?
Yes, we absolutely started it. And now as people are very quick to tell me, you know, enough is enough, and it's really gotten out of hand. But yes, Marcy and I actually did start that, I believe, and it was a natural thing to do. You know, when we flew out to California to meet with Jack, he said, you know, well, why should I let you do a book? You know, my office has a track record now. They were on the second Chicken Soup for the Soul book, right? A track record. And we just said, well, you know, we told him all the reasons that we thought we should do it. We had both been teaching business writing. We had been giving talks on Chicken Soup for the Soul, and so we really understood the genre. We had been speaking primarily to women's audiences. That was our specialty, so we really felt that we knew what women were hungry for. And, of course, I had majored in journalism. And he says, you know, you're absolutely right. And he said yes. And we did really start that whole niche market series.
And it was certainly a good decision for them, as well as for you and the other co-authors that followed in your footsteps.
Yes, definitely. I wish that they had followed the marketing track that's more like Harry Potter, you know, where one or two books were coming out per year so that people could really, really enjoy them. And but, you know, I remember being involved at that fork in the road when the decision was made not to go with, you know, a few books and create a big buzz around each one of them and really have that anticipation by large numbers of people. Instead, they chose the track of coming out with, you know, tons of books every year. And so there really is something for everyone, but I feel really, really fortunate because Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul and Mother's Soul and the second one for women, which Marcy and I did, and the one for Single Soul, which was our fourth book, all of them continue to sell. You know, all these years later, they're still very, very popular books.
Now, you don't have to answer this question if you don't want, but do you think that the quality of the stories was able to be maintained over such a large number of these books?
I can't actually answer that personally because I don't read any Chicken Soup for the Soul books that come out now. Mm. I had enough already. Thank you very much.
I'm waiting for Chicken Soup for the Chickens.
just be patient. I'm sure it will come along one of these days. but, you know, the feedback that I get from people is that the quality has suffered over time. Not over time and not completely across the board, because I think there are co-authors who come along who are very, very capable and who probably do a real quality job on their books. I don't know if anybody does the kind of work that Marcy and I did on those early books. I'm very, very proud of all of them. And I know the kind of heart, that kind of care that we put into them, and our devotion to making sure that they were just of the highest quality possible.
Great. Well, we're speaking with Jennifer Reed Hawthorne on Writer's Voices today, and we're talking about how she got started with the Chicken Soup for the Soul books. We have this blinking light in here. We got to figure out what to do about that. But Jennifer, you did four Chicken Soup books, and then what was your next step after that?
I contracted with my publisher to do two books at the same time, which was one of the biggest mistakes of my life. One of them was Diamonds, Pearls, and Stones, Jewels of Wisdom for Young Women from Extraordinary Women of the World, and that was a book that I co-authored with Barbara Holden. And then I did a book called The Soul of Success, A Woman's Guide to Authentic Power. And that came out in January of 2005, just a year after the Diamonds, Pearls, and Stones book.
That one I did
on my own.
That sounds very interesting.
Thank you.
Now, was the format of these books similar to a Chicken Soup book, or were they?
They're quite different, actually. Diamonds, Pearls, and Stones was a book of quotes. Barbara Holden and I, Barbara, as a former resident of Fairfield, of course, who many of our listeners will know, We felt so strongly that one of the things that's missing in our Western culture is that there's not a natural flow of wisdom from the elders to the younger people. In fact, our elders tend to be discarded and discounted in our society. As we mm-hmm. age, mm-hmm. we tend to be thrown away instead of valued.
Which is what we were talking about last week with our guest, Angela Sarian, The Second Half of Life.
And did you see that I had story from Angela in my book? Yes, I met her on a program that I attended a couple of years ago with Jean Houston. She was a member of the faculty, as were two other people whose stories I used in the book.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because I didn't have your book when I scheduled that interview, and we decided to focus November as interviewing female authors and sort of a general subject of feminine wisdom. And so we had Angelus, and then we had you, and then I had also invited Meryl Runyon, who is also in your book, and she'll be on with us November 30th.
Oh, fantastic.
So I know. It's just very coincidental.
Yeah, and next week we have for Womankind, is it?
Yes, yeah. Let me just mention that.
Oh, next good. I've seen the poster of this woman coming.
Nancy
Lee Carlos.
You'd
enjoy that.
Yeah. Terrific.
That.
Womankind, Connection and Wisdom Around the World. She was working as a nurse.
Yeah, as a nurse practitioner, and then was kind of trying to train people to be nurses and also doctors, people who had tried to start, you know, education as doctors and had been interrupted, and she was able to give them some help with that. Yeah. She was in Kosovo and Belize and all sorts of places. So, real interesting.
So anyway, back to your Diamonds, Pearls, and Stones, which was for women to pass some of their wisdom down to younger women.
Yes, and we had 10 different chapters with 100 different topics and just quotes from women that we met with.
See,
in
I would love that
here.
Book.
and then, you know, also celebrity quotes. We had a tremendous amount of research, and we mixed celebrity quotes with quotes of women that we know, both out in Colorado, where Barbara lives, in Fairfield. We really gathered women's circles and asked them to talk about different topics and, you know, recorded them and then transcribed what they said and then organized that material into all these different topics.
And at the same time, you're working on The Soul of Success, which how was that different?
Well, it was a collection of stories, but it was what made it different was that I talked about each one of the qualities. I wanted to do a book that was about a different kind of success. And that was why it was called The Soul of Success, because I had experienced, even after becoming a number one New York Times bestselling author on, you know, with two different books, that was not the answer to life. It funnily enough, you know, did not actually guarantee happiness more than anything else in life does.
But you're saying money does not happiness bring? Is that what you're
well,
saying?
Well, it can, and it can certainly help a lot, but it doesn't feel something deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really had a burning desire to write about success in terms of being rather than doing, and what I call the more feminine qualities, you know, because usually when we talk about the masculine and feminine aspects of life, the masculine we know is responsible for action and for focus and direction and for really getting things done. But the feminine qualities are the receptive qualities that have more to do with the way we are. And so I ended up having a series of chapters, each of which was a different quality, like compassion, acceptance, self-love. And I talked about each one of those qualities and then used a story that I felt really embodied that particular quality. So it was more than a collection of stories. It was my personal writing where I really wrote for the first time about my own experiences.
And I remember when I read that book, that thinking you were very brave.
Thank you, Monica.
Because you were very personal. And you revealed things that most people might prefer to keep to themselves, you know, about your life and about your journey. And
well, I think that that's one of the roles that I've been given in life. I'm able to see that as I mature, that what's really personal, you know, we're all so deeply connected. And I feel as though one of the things that allows me to love my life, which is this latest book, is the fact that I really am able to view every problem in my life, every situation, every challenge as a doorway, as a portal for going deeper. My hands are going outward, but actually I should allow them to come inward toward my heart, because those things have allowed me to experience greater self-discovery, greater understanding. And to me, there's nothing greater than self-knowledge, which brings peace. It all means
and happiness.
Greater peace. Yes, the happiness which is peace.
Yeah. So when you published those two books, The Soul of Success and Diamonds, Pearls, and Stones, this was your first time not being under the chicken soup umbrella.
Yes.
How did that make things different?
And it was hard. It was really hard, and I'll tell you, it gave me new respect for people trying to get books published in this world where anybody can write a book now. It doesn't matter what the quality is. It doesn't matter whether they have any expertise or any mastery whatsoever. They can put their own imprint on a book. We've got the technology to self-publish, and we have something like, 600 books a day being published, 6,000 books a day being published in this country.
Oh my word.
It's absolutely phenomenal. And what I found was I was working with the same publisher that publishes all the Chicken Soup for the Soul books, but neither of the books was a commercial success. They were hugely successful in terms of what I learned about them, but it is really, really difficult to get out and promote a book, even though HCI, my publisher, did a beautiful job in terms of the format of the book, the layout, the printing, the covers. Unless you are, J.K. Rowling or John Grisham, or one of these huge names, it's extremely difficult to get the kind of publicity that's really required to bring a book to the public's attention, unless it's just one of those flukes of destiny where someone publishes a book and all of a sudden, the next thing you know,
everybody's talking about it.
Eat, pray, and love, for example,
Dan
Brown's book.
Or the original chicken soup.
Yes.
Didn't they have to go to multiple publishers? It said, oh, that'll never sell. Nobody ever buy that.
Yes, over 30. That's right.
Yeah. And you had the advantage of already having a track record, being a published author, and yet it was still an immense challenge.
That's right. It was almost as if it didn't even matter.
Wow.
It was almost as if it didn't even matter. And that was a surprise to me also. It was really a huge
surprise.
Was
it a disappointment?
It was a disappointment in a way. But, I'm having to really stop and think about that, because I never really sort of consciously thought, gosh, this is so disappointing that
I put all this work into this.
I'm thinking about what I said a few minutes ago, that I see everything in terms of contributing to my life to such a huge degree. And I think that, not only did the content of The Soul of Success allow me to start transforming my own life, but it helped me through a very, very difficult time in my life, when I was going through a very painful divorce, and I was working on these two books, at the same time, which was having bitten off far more than I could chew. That was a huge mistake, and I really, really wasn't able to take care of myself, and so I learned so much that it was almost as if I hardly noticed that the books weren't bringing me a substantial income.
Right.
I know that will sound very, very odd to people, but that is as truthful as I can be about that.
Plus, something else really positive came out of The Soul of Success.
Yes, it
and
did.
And that is the book that you're holding in your hand.
That's right.
Right.
Let's tell your listeners what happened with that. This is so remarkable to me, because as I began to really, it wasn't that I began to accept. I always accepted, that those last two books had not been hugely successful commercially speaking. I just didn't give it much thought, really, because I had so much going on in my life, and because I had the great blessing also of being able to support myself, I wasn't depending on an income from those two books. So that made a huge difference also. I didn't have to worry about how to buy groceries. So that gave me the luxury of not having to wallow in the fact that these books weren't hugely successful. And as I began to make changes in my life that led me in the direction of greater and greater relaxation and greater and deeper understanding that I'm really not the doer, and that my destiny cannot possibly be kept from me. I do not have to feel like I've got to make something happen, oh my gosh, I don't have a book. I need to get out there and kickstart my speaking career again or something. Those are the kinds of old thoughts that I used to have. And as I started to relax into the understanding that Everything will come through me that is required of me in this lifetime and that I need in order to offer my gifts as well as to be taken care of. I got a call from my publisher. This was just this last January. And he said, Jennifer, the Chicken Soup for the Soul organization has been looking at your last book, The Soul of Success, and they would like for you to reformat this book for the new line of books that they have on life lessons. Are you interested? And it was so amazing to me because, number one, I thought that I would never do another Chicken Soup for the Soul book. Number two, I thought I would never work with HCI again. And it just felt so exciting to me. And I said, yes, let's at least have the conversation. We talked about it. We worked on a title for a while. I went to India for 2 weeks and then came back and started. And the thing that was so exciting for me was that I got to add a tremendous amount of material. First of all, people who pick up Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live, if you've read The Soul of Success, you'll see that many of the stories are the same. But a third of the book is brand new, number one. I also added stories from men, which was really, really delightful and very powerful. I edited dramatically with the help of some of my editors here in town, particularly Brian Aubrey and Cindy Buck, all of the stories that had been previously used, because The Soul of Success was a more sophisticated book in terms of being able to have longer stories of maybe 3,000 words long. Most Chicken Soup for the Soul books, the average story length is somewhere between 900 and 1,200 words.
Right.
So I was cutting stories anywhere from a third to two-thirds.
Wow. That's
and
not easy.
I have to say, I feel like every story without exception is more powerful in the shorter version. That was one of the biggest writing lessons that I had.
Did you also have the pause and reflect sections?
No, that was something that I added. Uh-huh. I also rewrote all of my introductions and wrote many new introductions. And then the beautiful thing to me was the restructuring in terms of these life lessons and the title. Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live, which I'd love to tell you, you know, the story of how that came about. After meeting with the CEO of Chicken Soup and one of the, another high-ranking official, we brainstormed for a couple of hours one day about the title. And by the time we finished, I wasn't happy with the title at all. What we had come up with, which I don't remember, I would share with you, was quite mediocre, unmemorable, let's say. And
obviously.
So I sat down because I didn't want to start on the book until I really knew what the title was, because I wanted to understand the direction, the angle that I was going to take to reformat everything. So I sat down one day and I closed my eyes and I said, how could I describe the essence of my life? And as I reflected on my life, I realized that there had been many moments in my life where I had experienced tremendous joy, even ecstasy, where I felt as if I died today, it would be okay because I have reached a level of fulfillment that could not be greater. I cannot imagine that it could be greater than this. But on this particular day, when I was sitting doing this reflection, that was not the case. In fact, I became aware, you know, that I was still experiencing some grief from my divorce. I was aware of a health challenge that I'd been working on for many years, and I was under tremendous financial stress. And so I found myself saying, then why is it that you feel so good? And as I delved deeper into that self-examination, I realized that while I don't always like the circumstances of my life, and they were really not so great that particular day, I really do love the way I live my life because of what I said previously in this hour, that I love what I bring to every situation, every challenge. I love what I'm learning about how to be present to everything, to not living in the future, but to really be present. I love what I'm learning about letting my divine destiny and divine intelligence flow through me. I don't have to do anything. The intelligence of the universe is so at work in everything, and I'm not an exception to that. So all I have to do is show up. I love the honesty that I'm learning how to live my life with, and that's really new for me because I think most of us are trained to live life not being honest, particularly to ourselves. We don't know how to tell the truth. We've been conditioned to not tell the truth. So we say yes when we mean no. We put everybody else's needs ahead of ours, especially we women. And we don't know how to take care of ourselves. We feel uncomfortable if we say, you know, I'm not really comfortable saying yes to this. And learning how to be honest is one of the things that I learned from writing The Soul of Success that has literally transformed my life. And so I came away from that exercise that day recognizing that I love not my life all the time, but I love the way I live it. And that's how the title came about, and everyone at Chicken Soup just loved it. And we kept the structure that Caroline was bringing up of talking about each life lesson first, then having a very powerful story to illustrate it, because that's really the heart of Chicken Soup. And then we added a little pause and reflect section where I offer one or two or three ideas or activities for people who like to do that kind of thing, for people who really want something concrete to help them integrate that truth or that lesson into their own lives.
And apply it.
Yeah.
Well, Jennifer, before we run out of time, would you please share a story from Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live?
Yes, I'd love to.
This is Jennifer Reed Hawthorne on Writer's Voices.
The fourth chapter of the book, which contains seven essential ingredients for finding balance and serenity, is a chapter that I called Holding Hands, Building Bridges. And it's about not only being willing to reach out to others when you need help, but also being on the reaching out and offering your hand. And the first lesson is called Let Love Lead. And I love this because, you know, it used to be politically incorrect for us to ever mention the word love in the business and professional worlds. And I've come to realize that if we don't start talking about love and paying more attention to it, we're going to really be in deep trouble. So It starts out with a Hindu proverb that says, help thy brother's boat across, and lo, thine own has reached the shore. They say that laughter is the best medicine, but love is the greatest healer of them all. I had just given a presentation for a client company on the Gulf Coast. It was a deeply connecting experience for everyone present, and the audience was still applauding as I walked off the stage and over to my purse to grab a pen before being whisked to the back of the room to autograph books. As I turned toward the back of the hall, a woman came up to me and opened and closed her mouth several times, as if she wanted to say something but couldn't. When she finally spoke, she told me that I had really messed up her plans. Confused, I asked what she meant. She told me that she had been planning to commit suicide the next night, but that now, after hearing me speak, she was going to have to rethink everything. I took her hand and looked deeply into her eyes. I knew that far more than what I had said, this woman had felt and received the transmission of love that had been so palpable in the room, generated not only by me, but also by everyone present. This love had healed, as love always does. But how does love heal exactly? It's the mind-body-spirit connection again. When the heart is touched, chemicals responsible for good health and a sense of well-being are released in the body. Research has found that when a person is a recipient of an act of kindness, his or her serotonin levels increase, strengthening the immune system. But interestingly, the serotonin level also increases in the person performing the act of kindness, strengthening his or her immune system as well. And amazingly, if someone simply witnesses an act of kindness performed by another, he or she also experiences the same physiological results and benefits. The story you are about to read is about medicine, the kind that helps the sick and injured. But it is first about love and what happens when love leads. In this story, love provides the clarity, the opening, and the grace for a miracle to happen. Do we have time to read the story, Monica?
5 minutes.
Okay, good. This is a story from Dr. Ali Tahiri, who was my host in Sarasota last week, and it's called Don't Take No for an Answer. And I wrote this story for Dr. Tahiri. He told it to me, and this is what we ended up collaborating on. For many years, it has been my privilege to play a role in bringing relief to thousands of people around the world who have been hit by natural disasters. Through the support of my family and Sarasota Sunrise Rotary Club Foundation, I have worked with earthquake victims in Iran, hurricane survivors in Florida and Mississippi, and brave souls in Sri Lanka and Indonesia in the wake of the 2004 tsunami. On October 8, 2005, 10 months after the disaster, I was on my way once again to Indonesia and Sri Lanka on another post-tsunami relief mission. Sitting in the transit lounge at Dubai International Airport, I suddenly heard on the news that an earthquake registering 8.6 on the Richter scale had just occurred in Pakistan. My thoughts immediately went back to the destruction I had witnessed in Iran, where the 6.6 earthquake had claimed the lives of 40,000 people. Now, with this news about Pakistan, I knew instantly that there would be a greater need for my services and expertise there than in Indonesia, where relief efforts had been continuing for 10 months. I was carrying $150,000 worth of medicine with me and the experience to use it wisely. Without taking another second to evaluate the situation, I went to the ticket counter and bought a ticket for Pakistan. Then, because I am a Rotarian, I called the governor of the Pakistani Rotary Club to notify him of my arrival. When I landed in Lahore, the airport was teeming with arrivals waiting to get through immigration. My request to be taken to the immigration officer was granted immediately, but my hopes were short-lived. After thumbing through my passport twice, the immigration officer informed me that I could not enter his country. I did not have a visa. I was aghast. I told him about my experience with disaster relief. I told him about the $150,000 worth of medicine, drugs, sutures, and splints I had with me. I explained, cajoled, and tried to reason with the man, but to no avail. After being detained for 2 hours, my patience wearing thin, I was told repeatedly that there was nothing they could do. It was the law. It was unthinkable to me that I was standing there with so much to offer and nothing but red tape standing between those desperate people and me. I remained undeterred. I asked to speak to the duty officer at the foreign ministry, who repeated what everyone else had told me. Their hands were tied. They could do nothing because of the law. Suddenly, something prompted me to ask him, who has written this law, God or man? After some thought, he admitted that man had written the law, to which I promptly replied, if man has written this law, not taking into account the possibility of an 8.6 earthquake, then man can change the law. There was a small opening. The officer asked me what I thought he should do. Change the law, I said, to permit anyone who arrives who has the expertise to help you to be granted a visa on entry. Then thank them profusely, offer them a cup of tea, and send them on their way to save a life or two. I got my visa. Along with the global community of Rotarians who joined me in my mission to help the victims, I was one of the first international aid workers in Pakistan. We worked in some of the most devastated areas where sliding mountains had destroyed roads and whole villages, burying thousands alive. Over 7,600 schools were destroyed, taking with them as many as 96% of their students and teachers. Since that trip, I have returned to Pakistan 4 times on follow-up relief missions and delivered more than $1 million of aid. As with every disaster area, the need is great and long-term, yet it is my honor to play even a small part. And oh yes, that law about the visas? It was changed the morning after my infamous encounter with immigration, allowing anyone arriving in Pakistan to help to be given a visa on entry. I am so grateful that I never take no for an answer.
Oh, what a wonderful story.
Thank you, Jennifer. And thank you for sharing with us today from Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live. And we are out of time.
Thanks so much for having me.
But I gotta give my quote because it's perfect.
Of course you do.
This is from Maya Angelou, who is a great wisdom. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, but if faced with courage, need not be lived again.
Mm. Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.